There we go. Yay. So, Jeff, welcome. And thank you so much. Yes.
We've been in touch for the last year or so, and it's nice to see who you are and be on your show today.
Yes, thank you so much. I'm really grateful. You came on my radar, I believe it was during the pandemic. Right? Notice how it's spelled, everybody. And I mean spelled in more than one way, right? Through Matt Arrett. And I watched a relatively long interview that you did with Cynthia and Matt, and I was just like really touched in my heart with everything that you were saying. And so I've been following you since then and then reached out.
Thank you. Yeah, you reached out by email.
And I got your big red book on China, and I'm going to link everything in the description below so that really encourage people to find your work, to find your platform. You have this wonderful, simple humanity of bringing like-minded, hearted people together to speak of what the heck is going on here and what can we do about it. In the different diverse ways that we have as different individuals with, all of our specificities. And one of the things that I know that I can do in my own way, and I am really passionate about geopolitics because it's the state of the planet, of our humanity on this planet, and of the animals, of course, as well, as they're impacted. The environments, the plants are impacted by what we do. And I'm passionate about coherency and about the coherency of systems. And I look to China. I've been connected with the Chinese culture since I was a little girl through the art. My mother,
I didn't know that.
yeah, my mother, well, it's from a kind of dodgy in a way. I mean, my mother came from a colonial family. She was born in Hanoi. And God knows what her father or her, I mean, I don't know exactly what kind of actions they may have had as colonialists, but they were in contact with the Chinese culture.
Oh.
So that was kind of the beginning of it for me. And anyway, I try to follow, well, no, I'm not going to put it that way. I follow your work to the extent, because you're very prolific. Right? And I love your humor as well. And so I wanted to connect with you and have this conversation. It's less of an interview in a way, and more of a conversation. But I am going to shut up soon and give you the
Well, I tell you what, I would love to know. I mean, I know the word coherent, but what in your mind is coherency? I like that term. I've never heard it before.
Oh, well, thank you for asking.
I always think coherent was just an adjective. I didn't know there was a noun, and please explain.
Well, it's a process. So it is a verb, even though we speak of it in terms of a noun. Coherency basically speaks to the dynamics of a system that is capable of self-organizing. And when I say self, it's that boundary condition between the individual and the collective is basically integrated as being something that is going to evolve and that is evolving in a direction of harmony. So for the physical human individual, usually coherency relates to heart coherency and an equilibrium of the central, I'm sorry, of the autonomic nervous system, which is basically going to be like oil in a machine, and it's going to facilitate all of our different functions from the visceral ones of, just the mechanics of our biological operation, all the way to the, more immaterial ones of our cognitive processes. And what's beautiful about it is that it's driven through the heart. And then you can then scale it out to the environment, because we're all connected. So the more coherent we are within ourselves, the more we facilitate coherency with each other. And one of the things I love about what I know about China, and some of what I know about China, a lot, in fact, comes through your channels, is that they're giving a beautiful entrainment and example of how to scale that coherency, from like the Tao Te Ching, about the being good in yourself and then your family and then your village. And it's like, this is what they're doing.
Actually,
So I'm
what you were describing, about scaling up and everything else, sounds like communism socialism to me.
Right.
That'll make some of the fans out there upset because there's so much brainwashing and Pavlovian reaction when you hear the words communism and socialism. But what you just described sounds like China to me.
Yeah.
So, and maybe that's why it's doing so well.
Yes, and I listened a little bit to your latest interview with I forget his name. Metallic Man?
Yeah, he's a character.
Yeah.
Love that
But
guy.
what he was talking about, like the plenum, the next 5-year plan, I just had me beaming. I was beaming. I was like, this is so beautiful. We can learn so much from this,
They have they plan. They have a vision. They're very visionary. They're not thinking about the next quarterly K report on Wall Street. They're thinking out 5, 10, 15, even 100 years into the future. So it's really, really hard for Westerners who have a very short attention span and who have a very short horizon to compete against that, and you can see the results on in the world today.
Yes, indeed. It's like the world is it's like humanity has an autoimmune disease, and the West kind of represents the core of that. The Western governments, not the Western people, although a lot of Western people are brainwashed, unfortunately. I know I was. I mean, I'm not saying I'm not at all anymore. I've just realized, when I look back and I'm thinking, gosh, I used to believe the shit I heard about Gaddafi, and when I realize what really happened in Libya today, it almost makes me weep, and then as well to China, because I've been, well, there was the aesthetics, the art, but then I've also been like a student of Tai Chi since I was like a teenager, and I had friends that went to Taiwan, but there was a lot of the people in Taiwan that were kind of pretty much, infiltrated by the CIA and Chiang Kai-shek's, and so they were all believing the bullshit about China. And so up until relatively recently, I had this kind of méfiance, a kind of a suspicion. And it's just started to fall away through looking at from people that have been there or that are there now, this, divergent sources, converging information. And it's like it's at the top of our bucket list is to go there.
But even being there is not enough. My wife and I lived there from 1990 to 1997. We had our first two we well our first two our two daughters were born during that time, and they were started being raised there. And I was working there, and we were tr sp I spoke the language and read the language beautifully. And managing companies and meeting many, many Chinese people. We, because my the my first 4 years was involved in agriculture, and so I was all over the country, doing sort of like field work in agriculture. So we saw lots and lots of lots of areas in China that at that time foreigners just didn't go to. And even with that 7 years of living there and working with the Chinese and being with the Chinese and speaking their language, that's not enough. You have to, I was an arrogant asshole. And I realize now that looking back, that it's because of what I, it's not really race. I'm not, it wasn't like, it's not like racism, but it's sort of like a cultural racism. It's sort of, the we Westerners are so brainwashed about our social superiority, our political superiority, our cultural superiority, our governance superiority, our technical superiority, our spiritual superiority. And you people don't realize how ingrained that is in us, at least my generation. And I don't know what it's, if it's the same for younger generations, but at least for someone born in the 50s, and I'm 70 years old now, I was an asshole. I mean, and I wish I could apologize to all the Chinese that I was such a jerk for, was such a jerk at. And it's not just me. We know people that have lived there, or lived there for basically their 20, 20, 30 years, raising their kids there from birth until the kids went off to university, working in China, and they are the same. They have that same attitude that I had from 1990 to 1997. This smug, we know better than you. I know better than you. We have all the right answers for you. You should do like we do, because we are superior to you in all those different categories. And it wasn't, and I and so I actually and I think about how profound that is, that I lived there for 7 years and didn't get it. And have met people who have lived there for 20, 25, 30 years, and they still don't get it. And yet, but it wasn't until I went back to, well, we went back in 2010. We went bankrupt in 2008 during the big rape of the middle class and the poor with the subprime scam. And so I guess that's what it took. I guess it took losing everything and moving back. And we just had like two suitcases each and $400 with our younger daughter. And I guess just not having anything, and all of a sudden I got it. I started going, wow, I could see China differently. It was a very humbling experience. And then I got it. And it was hard. And so that's what got me on my career for writing, and that's when I wrote 44 Days Backpacking in China, and saw the world with different eyes. Voila.
Oh my. Thank you so much for
I don't know. That's never happened.
One of the things that really drew me to you, I might start crying too, by the way. This is like the contagion of coherency, because what you're weeping are tears from the heart, And so one of the things that really drew me into really see, I felt that I saw you, and I know we haven't met, but I kind of think of you as an old friend.
I have lots of email friends, and phone friends in this business, in this line of business. You know, it's it, you know, I've met hundreds of people that I consider friends, even though we have not physically met.
That's
So
it.
anyway, I think that you have to go through, that's what you have to do with China. You literally have to strip yourself of all of your how do I want to say it, all of your presumptions and all of your convictions and all of your pride and all of your, it's hubris. I don't think Westerners realize how arrogant they are, and they don't mean to be, but they just are.
Yep.
So you have to lose that smugness, that arrogance. And that's the only way you can really, really see, China and the Chinese people. And because they are so different, they are absolute. It's like, it's, and I'm not saying this in any kind of racist connotation, but it's almost like you are trying to get to know aliens. They are that different from.
Yes. I have this intuition. You know, it's funny what you're saying because this morning I was reflecting and like also listening to this new video that you published on your I guess is it your Substack, your China Writers Group? It's just a wonderful. I'm gonna link to everything. But you know, I was just thinking in terms of we it's like it's an infinite universe, and it's definitely not just Newtonian. You know, there's room for other ways of considering things, and there's an incredible magic and potential when the individual and the group find a balance that we don't know yet here in the West because we haven't found that balance. It kind of goes back and forth between the individual and then the collective. And, you know, each time it's like maybe giving rise to new expressions of our potential, but we don't have the harmony. And I think that, I don't know, I suspect, I intuit, I feel even, but at a subtle level that the intrinsic there's an intrinsic harmony of that culture, which is a conglomerate of other cultures. It's like 50 at least, right? Different like groups and it just what it points to is I feel has such a transcendental, and I don't mean that in a woo-woo way. I mean that in a really grounded, practical way of transcending a limited way of operating and being to something that's greater and that is in, you know, that has more power, but in the noble way of creativity, of beauty, of truth, of goodness, and you know, poverty alleviation, and now. You know, the dictatorship of the people, if you read the Chinese Constitution, it's just friggin' amazing, you know? And the hubris you speak of, the arrogance is like, it's so immature. And, you know, the quicker that we can see how much we have to learn, you know, the better off we'll be. And the Chinese aren't going to wait for us, thankfully.
No, and they've been going at it for 5,000 years, so
Right.
they've had a lot of experience. I'm curious as to how you decide. You say that in the West we go from individual to group, but it seems to me like it's only individual. I don't see other than like it in wartime. Like World War II, or something like that, or the Great Depression, in the United States, which actually also affected Europe quite a bit. But it just seems like it's more the Marlboro Man than the group. Other than, USA, we're number one. That kind of general collective, sense of superiority. I just see, Westerners as being incredibly individualist and, me, myself, and I. What examples do you have, like, of them, going to a group? Are you talking about like a fraternity or a sorority or a club or a university or what?
Well, I guess the way that I the what I'm thinking when I say that, what I'm pointing to is you're right, because it but it's basically the individual. It's that it's why it's so dysfunctional, is because the passage from individual to group doesn't really happen. It happens through, well, yeah, you could small groups, the government, corporations, armies, as you're saying, fashion, all of these, social engineering dynamics that are basically toxic, and depending that can, sway people's consciousness to what's that term? To conform, right? So you have the individual conforming to the group, but in fact, what is really driving the dynamic is the ego. In terms of ego, meaning in this context, the little self, the limited, greedy, mortal, scared, psychopathic, sociopathic types of tendencies. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. That you're French, and I have French nationality, so you've probably been following the French elections. And this what you just talked about, there's a man that most of the listeners on this program will not know who he is, but a politician in France called Eric Zemmour, and he's absolutely brilliant. And but he is conservative, he's nationalist, he's patriotic, he's anti-immigration, and so he's very pro-French culture, pro-French, he's a conservative, Republican type. He's actually he's Jewish, but yet the Jews attack him because he's so honest about the situation in the West. And he made a remarkable statement that I have never heard a Western leader ever, or even a Western notable ever say. Is they a after the European elections, the right, the conservative, the Le Pen and the other members of the right. Of course, the left did it even worse, but he represents the right. They started tearing each other apart. Instead of getting together and saying, let's do something really good for the French people, let's do something really good for the future, they immediately dove into the mosh pit and just started tearing each other apart, destroying any unanimity, any cooperation, any potential to, for synergies. And the newscaster said, Mr. Zamora, why are they doing this? And he said, since the Greeks and the Romans, Western politics is all about destroying your enemy. He said, that's all that matters. And I have never heard a Westerner ever say that. And to actually go back to the Greeks and the Romans, he said it's always been that way. No cooperation. Destroy your enemies. Destroy people who are competition. destroy people who can, might have gained an advantage on you, destroy them. And I think that pretty much sums up, the West. I mean, it's not cooperation, it is conflict and destruction. And I really admired him for saying that, and I wished I'd recorded it, but I don't have a recorder. But I thought that was really brilliant. It's something I've been saying. I think the West is. This is what I figured out after 2010, when we lost everything and came back to China. But I think the West is fundamentally flawed, going all the way back to the ancient Greeks, 3,000 years ago. It's just. It is an unhealthy, sociopathic, too often psychopathic, culture, and this kind of this kind of destructive behavior, I think, is ingrained in the Western DNA. And I think that's why it seems to be finally catching up with the West in terms of geopolitics now, with Russia and DPRK and Iran and China and Venezuela and Bolivia and other, Cuba and other countries that are the BRICS. Finally, banding together to reject this incredibly, psychopathic behavior and psychopathic way of governing people, like we have in the West.
Yeah. Oh, I agree 100%. And it when I emailed you, to about some of the things we might talk about, just as a like in bulk, I said en vrac,
Yeah. I had to look up one of the words you sent. I didn't know.
Oh, was it ponerology, political ponerology?
Never heard that before.
It came up on my radar. I haven't read the book. It was written by a Polish, I don't remember the details, but I read some extracts from it and basically felt like I got the gist. But it's basically about, understanding evil, what we call evil, and how important that is. And you're speaking to this now with this quote from Zemmour. When I look and we spoke of, maybe doing another conversation in French for the French. When I look at what's happening in France, I really have to remind myself to breathe and not to get depressed or pissed off because, and it's just so pathetic. I lived in France for almost, for a couple of decades, and I was teaching kind of like coherency type of stuff. And one of the things that I realized and learned and also experienced directly, teaching kind of like self-development tools, like mental health, emotional health, resiliency, was how profoundly, and we are all, I mean, it's a broad sweeping statement, at least in the West. One of my teachers used to say, we're all more or less a little bit anyway. I mean, that's part of the human condition, neurotic, right? But my God, the level of anxiety, of low level anxiety in France is just heartbreaking. And a teacher that I have in France, I've never met him, but I really, really love his work. Maybe you've heard of him or know him, is Étienne Chouard. He's a political theorist, and he's just a really sweet, a clear, intelligent human being trying to teach the French how to be politically intelligent. Write their own constitution. And he, of course, he's left. He's on the left, but not what we're calling the left nowadays. I mean, he was attacked by, he had death messages sent to him by Antifa. Why? Because he thinks we need to be able to debate, to hold contradictory debates with anyone. And so he was saying how the left in France is so deeply insecure that they become, you know, it's this fear at the heart, at the core, that corrupts everything, and then that's weaponized by the elites in France, which are basically, you know, these really sick remnants or new iterations of, you know, like the Habsburgs and, you know, whoever won the bourgeois that won the revolution and stuff. But yeah, this socio, I wonder how, if there's like this thing maybe in the language, in the Latin-based languages, or Aristotle, from what I understand, that kind of got into the language so that we identify. You know, we use nouns a lot. We say, oh, well, I am this and I am that. And so we have a very separation-based, definition-based way of looking at things, which prevents us from seeing the whole.
I think that I have not read, maybe back in college I did, but I have not read, the great Greek classics, Aristotle and Plato and Socrates. But I understand Aristotle is what everybody has glommed onto, and he was basically, promoting, a totalitarian state. And I know Matt Arrett, our mutual friend, is very has a very good feeling about Plato, and that he was much more of a humanitarian, and maybe we could dare say much more Chinese or Confucian, and that but that but he doesn't get all but he doesn't get all the love. The love is is with Aristotle, because he was wanting to the ultimate police state. But I think the West, I wrote about this, in the, in fact, it's in the first chapter of the Big Red Book on China, how I think this it's ingrained in us, the this I in fact I even have it up on my board, the West 70s of racism and its expansionism. The ancient Greeks were very expansionist. If you look at a map of ancient Greece, how I mean they went all the way up in near the Black Sea. I mean they really spread out, and of course they exterminated everything in their sight, because they justified exterminating everybody by dehumanizing them, and they that's why we ha they would they ha that's why we have tr the Titans and the Cyclops, and all these horrific monsters that they dehumanize them into monsters, so that and also they didn't work the land, and they deserved to have the land taken away from them, and because they didn't do agriculture, and all they did was eat berries and have sex, and they were sex maniacs. So they really dehumanized the what I call the dreaded other, and those dreaded other were on the on over the horizon. And so that justified extermination, and that justified expropriation. Well, you're not working the land the way we work it. We're gonna, you don't deserve to keep it. So stealing their land, extracting what they can, enslavement. Of course, the Greeks got the slave economic model from the Egyptians. The Egyptians, they weren't expansionists. They were a closed economic system, because they had the Nile. They had the Nile River, and every year there was a bountiful harvest. And because they had, 30 centimeters of new silt, that that covered their lands, and so they had guaranteed beautiful harvests, and they had irrigation systems, and it was all based on slavery. The whole system was based on slavery. The Greeks got the slavery from the Egyptians, and this and it seems to me from Mesopotamia they got the idea. Gilgamesh, you know who Gilgamesh is? Yeah, the first book, the first poet, the first great poem. He was a big, dumb, horny, a giant, like the Titans, and so that was kind of the model. He just wanted to have sex, pick fruit off of the trees and not do anything else. And so they kind of, I think they got that from Mesopotamia. And so they got the enslavement model. And then I don't know how much the Greeks were evangelical, but I guess maybe they were, because look at Alexander, in 300 BC, going almost all the way to China. The West's first foreign policy initiative, conquering Egypt and most of Southern Asia. And I think, and that's just, it's, we are there. I mean, this is what we do. In fact, I was even taking some notes the other day. Then we had the Holy Roman Empire. Then we had Charlemagne, who had a slave, our good French king. He created an expansive slave economy and took over most of Europe. Then we had the Crusades, who were actually mostly French, who went to the Middle East, and they estimated to have killed 6 to 7 million, not only Muslims, but also Orthodox Christians. And then it seeped right into colonialism in the 1400s. And it's just like, it's basically been nonstop. Greeks, Romans, the Holy Roman Empire, and then Charlemagne, the Crusades, and colonialism, and now imperialism. That's what the West has given, or oppressed the planet Earth with for the last 2,000 years. I'm sorry, or 3,000 years. So it's just so much in our DNA, and I don't know how we're ever going to get rid of it.
It's like a virus.
And then you look at the Chinese, and it's like an alter universe. It's like, it's not even Islam was very evangelical and very expansionist. But they never dehumanized anybody. They just, I mean, I'm sure some people died, during their expansion, either become a Muslim or die, and some people fought against them and they lost. But they never ever dehumanized the people that they came in contact with. And the Chinese have six levels. They had, five or six levels of humanity, of course, the Chinese being the top, and then there were the Japanese and the Koreans, who were the next level, and then the went out in concentric circles out, across the world. And of course, the lowest level were the white people in Europe. But at no time did they ever dehumanize anybody that they came in contact with. They were always whole humans with souls, the same way with the Muslims. It's really the Western model that dehumanizes their enemies, that dreaded other, to the point that they are easily exterminated, genocided, enslaved, oppressed, robbed, raped. So I wish that that's why I wish that the West could get off their get off Westerners could get off their high horse and look at some of these other look at the East as a more humane and positive and productive and fairer and more just system. And I think that's the hard part is that Westerners have got to I now say it, the China, Confucianism, Taoism, Buddhism is superior to Judeo-Christianity. That's just all there. And that and this model that I talk about, the 7 E, the seventh E, by the way, is epidemics.
Yes, I was gonna ask you to say those E's.
Bioweapons and chemical weapons.
Right.
And but that this model, the West 7 E's of of racism, of superiority, is ri and you're in South America. Look at the American natives. They none of them went out, and even the Aztecs and the Incas, they had their wars between the Aztecs had their wars and the Incas had their wars and who what's the third one I'm leaving out? And
Mayas?
who?
Mayas?
Yeah, the Mayans, they had their interesting wars between their different groups, but none of them went out and tried to march north into Mexico and take over the Iroquois and the hundreds of tribes in North America, the hundreds of tribes in South America. None of them that I know of have tried to go, tried to take over, huge areas. Look at Africa. They had great, they had massive, they had incredible kingdoms, and incredible civilizations. None of them went out and tried to take over, an area as big as the the Democratic Republic of Congo or whatever. They had their local wars. They had their their war, their turf wars, et cetera. But that's as far as it got. It's really the only the other culture that is expansionist was were the Mongols. And it's really interesting. A lot of people don't know this, although I don't think it would have mattered. The Mongols are the only other group that are very, very expansionist, or were very expansionist. But Genghis Khan was adopted Christianity, and so he had the Old Testament to give him all he needs to know, the Pentateuch, the Jewish Torah, that justifies extermination and expansion and enslavement and rape and pillage. And so he had, in fact, Kublai Khai Khan's mother was a Nestorian Christian. So the Mongols were Christian, but it wouldn't have really, even if he hadn't had the Bible, that is the only other group that I know of that is bona fide, that was extremely, expansionist. The Siberian steppe tribes were very, very expansionist. And of course the Genghis Khan, took over, rolled over China, in the 1100s, for 140 years. So he took over the entire, he took over all of China and got all the way to Budapest, or was it Vienna? He expanded in Europe. So that's the only other one that is expansionist that I know of, unless you know of another one.
I think I remember Matt Arrett recently speaking to yes, this connection between Genghis Khan and the West, in fact, that there was a direct link that not necessarily enabled but encouraged and facilitated this way of being in the world. And I wonder about Christianity because I feel it has this a kind of an embedded schizophrenia when the core teachings of Jesus or of the Essenes, and or it's like the there's a deep mystical truth and wisdom that is like a common trunk in all of the psyches of humanity. But then the way that that evolved or turns into a religion, the Christian religion has, been the driving force of so much destruction. It's something to it's something to behold. This the thing about that I understand about psychopaths, which is kind of a freaky thing from what I've learned, what I've from reading or hearing about studies. It's they're not necessarily because they were abused or whatever, they turn into monsters. They can actually be born that way, and there's actually a different neurology where they're like missing. They don't have the capacity for empathy because they don't have like the same system of mirror neurons, just to speak to that biological mechanism that makes it that's like we have something that allows us to to learn from each other's faces, but in a way that's coherent with what we're feeling in our hearts. And psychopaths don't do that. It's like they don't have a heart. And there was some Australian psychologist or psychiatrist who did a study, kind of an epidemiological study, a psychological, that showed that whilst in a normal, so to speak, normal, let's say you have a village with 100 people, you may have one or two people, 1 or 2% that have sociopathic tendencies, right? Basically, they're like real jerks, and just people know that, and they're going to know how to deal with it. But in the West, in any case, in the higher you get in the echelons of power, whether it's corporate or governmental, institutional, that proportion rises tremendously to like 20 to like 30, who knows, percent, And we need to stop being stupid and see, we really need to grow up and become sovereign and stop believing all of the stuff that gets fed to us in the West. And this is one of the reasons we're having this conversation, because the Silk Roads, the BRICS, the Shanghai Cooperation Agreement, what's happening, I think, with the flowering, the emancipation of this culture, this multimillennial culture, and its friends and its network, is that the prosperity is going to become more and more available to common people here in the West. And so it'll be more difficult to drive through the scarcity, through the enslavement of debt, and of the way money is falsely created here by private systems, so that we can actually tip over to another way of sharing resources. And that's what communism is. And Etienne Choual, that I mentioned to you, I love the way he describes communism. He said, and I'd love to speak with him and get in touch with him, because he also says stupid things about China. So he needs, and but he's willing to be educated. He's super sweet. That's my impression of him. But what he said about communism was, look, you have to realize that everyone who grew up in a healthy, relatively healthy family, not a dysfunctional family, has experienced communism, where the resources are shared, everybody gets to eat, everybody has a place to sleep and clothes and is warm and is cared for and gets TV time or whatever, pet the dog, play in the yard, go on vacations. That's what communism is. And then another thing that really struck me recently, I don't remember where I picked this up, it might have been through your channel somewhere, was that the Chinese themselves said, well, we don't call it communism, it's socialism with Chinese characteristics, because we're not yet civilized enough to actually practice true communism, maybe in 4 or 5 centuries or something like that. And I was like, wow.
Let me I'd like to address the Christianity. I think one of the reasons that Christianity is so schizophrenic is kind of an unfair term, but it's so it, because it because it because it's loaded with so much baggage. But why conflict is a good word. Why Christianity is so conflicted is it has two books. It has the Old Testament and it's got the New Testament. And in the Old Testament is the first five books of the Old Testament is the Jewish Torah, which in the Bible is called the Pentateuch. And in the Old Testament, especially the Pentateuch, God is an angry, vengeful, jealous, violent, entity who justifies the 7 E's of racism. Well, maybe not the epidemics, but the expansionism, the extermination, the expropriation, the extraction, the enslavement, and the evangelism. Definitely, that's the old. Well, and maybe even not even the evangelism. That's probably more in the New Testament. But this model of expansion, enslavement, and just stealing everything you can get your hands on, it's all justified because we are the chosen people and they deserve to die because and the women deserve to be raped and the children deserve to be enslaved because they're not really human after all. I mean, that's unfortunately what the Pentateuch contains. And that's part of the Old Testament. And so and he the God in the Old Testament, he's not a nice guy. I mean, he is a really he's pissed off. He's very, very vengeful. And then you've got the New Testament. And you got Jesus Christ, who was basically a communist. And he's the one that threw who threw the money changers out of the temple. He's the one that sharing and compassion and helping each other and feeding and everybody should. So you have this incredible conflict, and so I think that's why a culture like the United States and England, the Anglo-Saxon countries, are fundamentally Protestant, and Protestantism is Old Testament. And then you have countries like France and Italy and Spain and Portugal and parts, much of Germany that are very Roman Catholic, and Catholics are very New Testament. And you can just see how the people here act and think compared to Americans, that this is definitely a New Testament culture in France, which is kinder, gentler, more concerned about other people, helping other people, taking care of other people. Whereas with the hard-nosed, Protestants, go out and get a job. You're hungry, go get a job. Pull up your bootstraps, boy. That kind of. Old Testament, tough love. So I think that's why Christianity is so conflicted. But the problem is, as you say, the people who rise up in the military and the people who rise up in government and in leadership position and in corporate positions, they don't read the New Testament. They read the Old Testament. And so to justify all that they do, and then I don't know if you've read it. There's a really good book called Snakes in Suits. Snakes in Suits, and
Night.
it's about psychopaths in the corporate world.
Yeah.
It points out how these people in the America, in the Western society, are the ones that float to the top, as you were talking about. These are the psychopaths and the sociopaths are the ones that end up being on top of the shit heap, running the show. And I think also because of this. Because of this, this Old Testament, this Old Testament mentality, I have read, the 2% supposedly is the 2% psychopaths, is supposed to be the number in a general society. But I'd have to look up where I'd have to find my references. But people have been done studies, and in the West. In the West, especially in the United States, when the definition, of course, psychopathy and sociopathy is kind of is a continuum. It's a continuum, and there's many different degrees of psychopathy and sociopathy, and when is someone a sociopath and not a psychopath, and vice versa. But they said that when you really look at least American culture, that no fewer than 15% of the people are sociopaths, not 2%.
Oh, wow.
And well, sociopaths, psychopaths, and that, and if, and then if getting into just nor that's 15% psychopaths, and then up to 25% if you get just sociopaths, sociopath, misanthropic, violent, et cetera. It could be up to 25%. Whereas in China and in Asian cultures, it really is about 2%. It really is 2%. So Confucianism, Taoism, and Buddhism do not encourage psychopathy and sociopathy. Whereas unfortunately, Western civilization does. And then also because of the model of Confucianism, Taoism, and Buddhism, it weeds out these horrible people and keeps almost most of them from rising to the top. So it's almost like an anti-universe. They do a really good job of eliminating the these exterminators and genociders and murderers and enslavers. Whereas in the West, they're the ones that tend to end up being in power and running corporations.
Wow. That makes so much sense. It's it reminds me this whole this polarity. It's like, that proverbial story of the two wolves. Which one are you feeding? And it's like looking at the world through this lens of, it's like, well, it's, the we talk about the global South. I wonder here in South America, because sadly there's Argentina and a lot of the Zionists that have infiltrated, and what happened in Chile with Pinochet, the CIA, just what they're trying to do now in Venezuela. It really comes down to being able to see this, to be able to recognize it, and to understand, or to feel what the ramifications are. And then to educate, to, well, th first through one's own practice, So one of the things that I've been learning been and I'm still learning is really to is to disengage from all of the kind of chaotic anger, vengeful, this archetypal Old Testament God that might be alive in me, not as a God, but as a feeling, consciousness. And to more and more just cut that at the root, and to be and still to hold the vision, and to see that the this exists, but it behooves me not to feed it. And so I see that one of the main manipulations that goes on in the Western world is to keep people down by keeping them angry and frightened, which is the projection of what these oligarchs are, these
And
psychopaths are,
divide and conquer.
right? So to not be like all airy-fairy or woo-woo, or yeah, everything's perfect, I love everybody, and yet to have that capacity of compassion, but to also have the sword, which is, well, you're going, you need to go to jail, or what I'm saying, that there's a solid, effective immune system, that keeps us healthy and capable, excuse me, capable of engaging and of growing and of gardening and turning. I mean, I'm really excited to see what the Chinese are going to come up with next in terms of like technology coming from such a deeply, Confucian, Taoist, Buddhist, wise worldview that is capable of doing all this connectivity through the high-speed trails and then going into Laos. And you were speaking to, what's his name, Nima. I've heard listened to some. I love his show, and I loved what you brought to his show.
I've been on twice. I haven't been asked back. I'd love to get back on, but he has a he has a wonderful show. I really enjoy his stuff.
Yeah.
Can I say something about communism?
Please.
Well, another way that the West is completely out of sync with most of the rest of humanity is that I have always, well, you've got Big Red Book on China. I juxtapose a picture on the first page of Karl Marx with Cheng Tang, the first emperor of the Shang Dynasty, which goes back to like the 1,700 years before Christ, saying that the Chinese have been communist for 5,000 years. And but it's not just China. When you really look at it, outside of Europe and its spawn in North America and Australia and New Zealand, most of the rest of the world for thousands of years has been communist. The Native Americans had, magnificent, civilizations where they had councils, governing councils where women had a huge voice in the daily governance of the people. You go to Africa, you go to Asia, you go to Oceania, you go everywhere in the world except in the West. And and communism is not strictly, Marxist, Leninist, Stalinist, Maoist communism. There's all that. That's political communism. But there is all kinds of, communist communism around the world. For thousands of years, tribes and peoples and cultures and civilizations, kingdoms everywhere, they shared resources. They shared housing. They shared food. They took care of each other. They cooperated. The Chinese for thousands of years have shared their draft animals and their tools, and have collectively grown crops, going back thousands of years, helping each other, with labor, during times of need, helping each other when they were sick. This has been going, that's New Testament. That's the New Testament. And that has been going on, that has been going on across North America, South America, Africa, Asia, and Oceania for thousands of years. And it's again, that is a definition of communism, a collective security, taking care, taking care of each other, educating each other, et cetera. So that's the other reason that the West just sticks out like a sore thumb. They're like Marlboro Man, the Marlboro ads in the United States, the lone cowboy. That's the ideal in the West, is that individual, I can do it myself. I don't need anybody's help, which is has never been true. It's a myth. And but the fact that it is an ideal and it's admired and strived for is tells you all you need to know about why the West has so many problems. And it's now with, again, as you said, BRICS and SCO, and then also in South America, CELAC, CELAC and Mercosur, and all these other groupings that are gathering together. It's the West is now, instead of being in control, is now struggling and with their model of governance and society. One other thing, you mentioned Malay. Do you know a guy on YouTube called Richard Medhurst?
Yes.
He lives, I think, maybe in Syria or Turkey. I don't know where he's somewhere.
Yeah.
But he had he
Lebanon. I
oh,
think he.
is he in Lebanon?
I think so.
Anyway, he had like a quick 10-minute show about names of Israeli leaders, and none of their names are real. They're all fake, and because they're all from Europe, so
Right.
they have all these instead of what is it, Sharon or whatever, his name was actually Patskowski, and he Golda Meir was actually named again some Polish or German or German or Dutch name,
Or
and
Ukrainian name.
a Ukrainian, yeah. And he actually pointed out that Javier Milei and Benjamin Netanyahu actually have the same name. Their birth names are Milekowski.
Oh.
Their names are Milekowski. They both have the same last name, Milekowski.
Well,
Milekowski in Argentina, they chopped off the last half and just made him Malay. And of course, Benjamin Netanyahu just changed his name from Milekowski to Netanyahu to sound Semitic.
oh my gosh, that's really interesting. It For some reason it yeah, I think that's another really important, aspect for people to grasp in the West, because there's a lot of people waking up to the Palestinian plight and the evil of Zionism. But they don't realize that the or maybe they do, but it's not it needs to be, clarified more as to Israel, that this the so-called state of Israel, the entity, the Zionist entity, is basically, it's basically just it's a bunch of Europeans and Americans, which are basically Europeans, that gone through the US, and there I don't think there's any Jews of Native American descent, right? I mean, Israelis, I don't I'm not confusing the Jews with the Israelis, but with the, I'm separating the Zionists and the Jews, and what you're saying is, yeah, it makes so much sense, and it reminds me also of something I read sometime last year that basically showed that Zuckerberg, the owner of Facebook,
What?
was yeah, he was connected to the what are the Habsburgs.
Oh, really? Wow.
If my memory is correct, so don't, please, everybody, do your due diligence. Don't take everything we're saying as, some kind of right? I mean, it's always the same story of we really need to go within. I have a what you were speaking to about with communism. I just gosh, I extracted one quote, but I there's so many others. I encourage everybody to get your beautiful book. I haven't finished reading it, by the way, because I'm a slow reader, and it's a big book, the big red book on China. Right,
Big red book on China.
and I have the digital version, so it's pretty light, but it's still a lot of pages, and but really beautiful. It's also, I want to say, beautifully written. It's really a pleasure to read.
Thank you. I'm humbled and honored for someone of your caliber and intelligence and experience to say that. That means a lot to me, so thank you.
Well, back at you. You wrote Western Empire, and this is, I think, from like even the just the first chapter. Western Empire has never forgiven China for overthrowing the ongoing colonial order, and to this day spends billions trying to undermine, subvert, and overthrow the CPC and China's modern independent way of life. This onslaught of subterfuge and treason has failed miserably due to the Chinese's long historical adaptation of a communist system of society and governance going back thousands of years.
That's true. That's why they can't beat them. That's why they can't beat them. And if and as Metallic Man said, their technology is just going to go. It's just going to go sky high. I mean, they're just getting warmed up, and instead of using it to create wealth for the 1%, they will use it to help the 99% and create a better life and better society and a better environment and a better world, not only just for the Chinese, but they're also sharing this, which is why everybody wants to work with the Chinese, is because they're also sharing much of this technology with Africa and the rest of Asia and South America. So that's absolutely true. And there was something I wanted to ask you about. I just wanted to say that I think Zionism is somewhat it's somewhat of a diversion, a psychological deflection. So Zionism is nothing more than the Western model, the Western model, the seven E's of racism. But it's imperial, colonialism, imperialism, expansionism, but it's just unique to Palestine. They just gave it a name, and it is dominated by Jews, but it's no different than capitalism in Africa, Western capitalism in Africa, Western capitalism and imperialism in South America and across Asia and Oceania, wherever they can get in and subvert governments and turn them into vassals like South Korea and Japan, and now unfortunately the Philippines again. And after Rodrigo Duterte's one term as president, he's the only one that in Philippines history who has actually stood up to Western Empire. But it's a synonym. It's a synonym for Western, capitalism, imperialism, and colonialism. That's all it is.
Yeah, I
So,
appreciate that. Thank you. Yeah, I thank you for bringing the attention back on basically the common denominator, so to speak, the root, the root, because it helps to simplify as well and not get lost in these different labels. But yeah, that's my understanding of it. When I say Zionism, I'm not just focusing on that, but it's that those the seven E's, that virus, that psychic virus that the Western cultures seem to hold and to try to, that to try to subjugate the rest of the beautiful host of this planet and our human brothers and sisters and all the animals and the plants and this beautiful ecosystem on this tiny blue-green raft that we live on, which is also just the infinite universe is also inside. And I don't want to take up too much more of your time. I'm enjoying myself and I'd love to have some more conversations with you, but I just want to say one more thing before we and get your feedback on it or your input on it before
I wish.
we close, is that coming back to this systems view of an organism and of the coherency and of the example of how the Chinese culture is showing us this beautiful capacity for scaling harmony, from the individual to the, to billions of individuals. The autoimmune, whatever you want to call it, disease of the West, of capitalism, of empire, of the seven E's, and we'll list them down as well, that you basically put in a nutshell. Well, there's something called when an individual has a life-threatening disease, which we might say, well, maybe humanity has a life-threatening disease, right? I mean, with nuclear weapons and all this biological weapons and all of this other crazy shit, excuse my French, is spontaneous remission. In other words, the there's the individual that is ill, that has the deep enough, I don't know how to describe it because I'm not, it's not like I've gone through it myself, and I've had close, very close beloved persons die and not spontaneously remiss from life-threatening cancers or other things. But I know that it's more than possible. It's just like it happens all the time. And I feel like this is one of the things that's going to happen, that is happening perhaps even as we speak, though we may not see it because there's still so much gangrene and sickness and disease and suffering and horror. But the tipping point is that there is this capacity for healing, and it happens, and it grips all of the cells in the organism. And it's not explainable in Newtonian terms, in linear terms. It's almost like this, and I think that that's one of the things that we're doing, you and I, and then all our friends, all your friends, your platform with the China Writers Group, and other people who are listening to us, people and everybody, in their own unique ways, is to basically pulse to broadcast this vibration, which is something that we could measure, of health, of wholeness, of harmony, of compassion, of creativity, of courage, of innovation, of vision, of ideals, of humanity that the Chinese classics really spoke to. I have so much faith in that. I know that it's happening. It's just, yeah, it's the paradox of it's like it's already there, and we must make it happen, right? Otherwise it won't. Something like that.
I appreciate you finishing off the show with a healthy dose of optimism and hope, because the world needs it right now.
Okay.